Radio silence until further notice. Good luck, the message ended. Can the Branson defend itself? Mars asked Cheryl.
Back in the day, the Branson was a naval interceptor, Cheryl said. But these days it pulls courier duty. It's not armed for battle. It has defensive weaponry, that's it.
So if that other ship is hostile, the Branson is a soft target, Hanton said.
Captain Lorry will put up a fight, Cheryl said.
That's not what I asked, though.
Your ship is under attack?
Chenevert asked Mars, watching the conversation.
Not yet, Mars said. But maybe soon.
Not from the Dallas Islands.
No. It occurred to Mars that Chenevert, asleep for 300 years, might not be caught up on current events.
Then from whom?
We don't know yet.
I regret to say that I'm not in a position to offer much help, Chenevert said. I'm using stored battery power for gravity and life support. The ship will be warm enough for you soon, but reactivating the engines will take several hours.
Anything we can do to help?
Thank you, no. This ship's engineering section is entirely automated and was even before I became the ship. You'd just be in the way.
The ship is going to go behind Dallas Isla Prime soon, Hanton said. We'll be cut off from the Branson no matter what.
If anything happens to the Branson, we're screwed, Gamis said.
You're welcome to stay here, Chenevert said to him.
That's great, Gamis replied sarcastically. Got any sandwiches?
Quiet, Private, Cheryl said. Gamis shut up. Cheryl looked over to Mars.
He's not wrong, though.
Mars nodded. What supplies do we have on the shuttle?
Enough protein bars for about 5 days for each of us. Probably about 3 days of water each.
I have water, Chenevert said.
No food, though, Mars said.
Sorry, no. Even if I did, after 300 years, you wouldn't want it.
So all the water we need, but still only 5 days of food, Cheryl said.
The Dallas Islands would feed us, Mars said.
They can barely feed themselves, sir.
Not to mention we can't get out of our suits without risking infecting them.
What's happened to the Dallas Islands?
Chenevert asked. Mars considered what to tell Chenevert about the Dallas Islands and how to say it.
It's complicated, he finally settled on. But the last 300 years have not been great for them.
Oh, Chenevert said. Oh, dear.
Are you sure the engines will come back online? Mars asked.
They should, Chenevert said. I've been asleep, but the Auvergne has done regular checkups on its systems and processes. I can tell you every system on the ship is functional.
What about weapons? Cheryl asked.
This is not a warship, Chenevert said.
No missiles or physical weaponry, and after 3 centuries, those would be of questionable utility anyway. But, as it happens, before I left Pontu, I had cause to install an array of beam weapons.
What was the cause? Gamis asked.
Let's just say that I anticipated that when I needed to leave Pontu, it would be suddenly, and that I might be chased. And that those chasing me might prefer that if I couldn't be caught, that I should be rendered into very small pieces.
What are you, a criminal?
That would depend on who you ask, Private Gamis, Chenevert said. Although anyone you might ask that of is now dead.
The beam weapons, Cheryl asked. Do they work?
They should, once the engines are spun up. They're not routed through the engines, of course, but they draw power from them.
You're thinking we should go after the other ship, Mars said to Cheryl.
I would, if it were my ship, Cheryl said.
But it's not my ship.
Everyone turned to Chenevert.
Well, this is all very sudden, Chenevert said.
Asleep for 300 years? Wake up to 4 strangers on my ship, and not 15 minutes later I'm asked to ride into battle for them.
That's a very different situation than just offering temporary hospitality.
Is that a no? Cheryl asked.
It's an, I'm giving it a thought.
Chenevert turned to Mars.
We have another 6 hours at least before the engines are spun up, Lord Mars. I suggest we spend it with you getting me up to speed on current events.
That's a lot, Mars said.
Chenevert nodded. Just the last 300 years will do.
Chapter 17. Nadache had not seen her mother in this much of a state for years. Part of that was Kiva Lagos having turned Tinda Luantintu into a punching bag, although that was less about the well-being of poor Luantintu than it was about Lagos sending the message for the Countess to get the fuck off her planet. The Countess did get the fuck off the planet and returned to the Blame in a fury. But that was only a small part. The larger part was that Jason and Darren Wu were coming for a clandestine visit to the Blame, to meet Nadashe and to detail to the Countess all their plotting in this exciting nascent conspiracy they had going. Nadashe's brain put sarcastic emphasis on the word exciting here, because to date it had been anything but that to her. In point of fact, her only role in the current conspiracy to overthrow Greyland II was to be married off. This rankled Nadashe. She had no problem with being married off when she was a full participant in a scheme. That's how it had worked with Renarid Wu, the Crown Prince. Nadashe had gone into that one with eyes open and with full consent and active participation. She had wooed Renarid by letting him think he was the one who had been doing the wooing. Charmed him and amused him and fucked him and complimented his skills all well enough that Renarid would think the match was something more than a practical political union. It would have meant that Nadashe had to wear a mask for the rest of her life. Well, the rest of Renarid's life, at least. One that showed what could be thought of as love for the man. Nadashe had been willing to do that in return for everything she and the House of Nohama-Peton would have gotten out of it. And anyway, she hadn't hated Renarid. He was shallow and had a facile intelligence at best. This was why Ahmet had liked him so well, since they were cut from the same thin cloth, and he was led by his dick enough that Nadashe had known that it was a thing she would be required to manage, since she wouldn't be able to curtail it entirely. But he was not a horrible person or cruel. He was appropriately respectful and affectionate, and knew the correct times and place for each, and he was tractable. Nadashe could have easily worked with that. And then one day, suddenly, he wasn't affectionate and tractable, and he was going to call off the announcement of their engagement. Aside from the massive loss of face Nadashe would endure, which was significant but something she could live with, the House of Nohama-Peton would suffer a significant decline in its status. All the other houses had been doing business with the Nohama-Petons with the implicit understanding that in a generation, one of its own would be on the throne. With the name of Wu, to be sure, but there was no one who thought that once Nadashe was the Emperor's wife, the Nohama-Petons would not be the ones running the show. Everyone acted accordingly. But if Nadashe was thrown over, all that went by the wayside. And then the other houses would begin their own frantic competition for the crown. The Emperor's marriages were almost always political unions, in one way or another. If there was a little love thrown in there, that was fine. Ottavio VI, as an example, was known to have been excessively fond of his consort, Glenna Costou, whom he married because the House of Costou had bailed out his mother, the infamous Zetian III, from some ruinous personal investments that would have bankrupted the imperial private accounts. But in an empire that was aggressively dynastical, the only way for a house to move up was to marry into the House of Wu. Every marriage was political, and in the political arena, if Nadashe was tossed to the side, so was the House of Nohama-Peton. In the end, the problem solved itself when Renarid rammed his car into a wall during that race before he could formally announce that he would not be moving forward with his engagement to Nadashe. He was dead, and there would be a different Emperor, and given what was known of the mousy, indifferent creature that was Cardinia Wu Patrick, it would be highly unlikely that Nadashe would be the imperial consort. But the House of Nohama-Peton was still first in line to marry into the throne. Nadashe had always been impressed with how well her mother had managed that assassination. It had been flawlessly executed, done so well that even those with suspicions, which would have been the entire Imperial Guard and the Ministry of Investigation, could find nothing suspicious in the wreck. The Countess had not told Nadashe she was going to do it, or how it was going to be done, or when it would happen. The Countess had not even been in the system at the time. Nadashe had been as shocked and horrified as anyone when Renarid died. For 5 minutes. After that, she had wondered how it had been done. She had been smart enough until just the last few days never to outright say to her mother that she knew her mother had done it. The only reason Nadashe had said it at all was that she was meant to be dead herself. It couldn't hurt. And her mother was all, "Of course I did it. It had to be done." The point was, from the moment that Nadashe pointed herself at Renarid Wu to the moment he crumpled into that speedway wall, she had been a full participant in events. She was aiming to be a wife, but she was the one doing the aiming. This time, she was just being offered up. "Stand straighter," the Countess said to her daughter as they stood, waiting for their visitors. "I am entirely straight," Nadashe said. "You look like you're slouching." "Does it actually matter, Mother? I've already been bought and sold, have I not?" "Yes, you have," the Countess said. "But you haven't been taken home yet. You could still be returned. It's happened before. So, straighten up." Nadashe sighed and overextended her back ever so slightly. The Countess, satisfied, returned her attention to the door. Jason and Darren Wu were about 5 years apart in age, but looking at the two of them, Nadashe would have thought there was a decade or more between them. Jason, more than a decade older than Nadashe, was heavy-set and untoned, with a face the consistency of dough and a haircut that could only be described as brusque. His face showed intelligence but not curiosity. This was a conservative man, Nadashe could see, and not in the useful way of being cautious but practical and deliberate. He simply wanted things done the way he wanted them done, which was the way they had always been done. Nadashe expected in bed he would be a sodden lump. Darren's hair was great, in a way that was cared for, but not over-attended. His suit fit well, and he fit well into it. His face was intelligent and also engaged. Nadashe watched as his eyes took in the room and the details of it, not neglecting herself and her mother. He had energy in his step. He was also a conservative man, it was clear, but his conservatism had a method and ethos to it beyond "this is just how it's done." Darren, Nadashe was sure, would be happy to be flexible on methods if the results were the same, and what he wanted, which would be the status quo with him on top. Nadashe expected that in bed, Darren would get her off and then get his, making sure to always get his. "And of course I will be stuck with the lump," Nadashe thought. The Countess welcomed both of the men to the room. Darren warmly but perfunctorily, and Jason with more effusion. It was clear to anyone who looked which of the two the Countess had decided was the more important. Darren, for his part, seemed to be amused by this. "Jason, this is of course my daughter Nadashe," the Countess said, and Nadashe took her cue to walk up, hand extended. Jason took it in a very businesslike grip. "Lady Nadashe," he said, "I am delighted." "Wonderful to see you, Lord Jason," Nadashe said.
I wanted to apologize to you, Lady Nadashe," Jason said.
"What for, sir?"
"While you were in prison, one of my associates..."
"Oh yes, right. The spoon murderer."
"In retrospect, not the best decision I could have made."
"Lord Jason, you are acting in what you believed were the best interests of your house," Nadashe said, "as you are doing now. I can honor that sentiment, even as I can say I'm grateful that your associate was not as competent as you might have hoped for at the time."
"Even so, you have my apologies."
"My dear Jason,"
Nadashe said, dropping the Lord to give the appearance of fond familiarity,
"if we are to be emperor and consort, then the first things we have to let go of are the trivial matters of the past. There is nothing to apologize for. There is only what we can accomplish moving forward."
"Well, good then," Jason said, smiled, and turned his attention back to the Countess Nohama Peaton. Nadashe, who had tuned what she said to be warm with just a hint of intimate, was nonplussed by this. All that effort for nothing. She turned to see Darren, a small smirk on his face. He, at least, had gotten what she had been up to, and how it had failed to be received. Indeed, as the four of them sat down and began to discuss matters of a conspiratorial nature, it became abundantly clear that Jason was entirely about business, that being the business of the Countess Nohama Peaton's plan, which she laid out in detail. Jason listened and offered cogent but unremarkable comments and details, and within 10 minutes it became clear that for this plan and the organization of it, Nadashe and Darren were surplus to requirements. Every now and again, she or Darren would chime in with a comment or idea. That comment or idea was momentarily acknowledged to exist by the Countess and Jason, and then the both of them proceeded with their own planning. After a half hour of this, Nadashe needed a drink. Darren accompanied her to the bar.
You're feeling as useful as I am right now, I imagine.
Useful is an interesting way to put it.
She poured herself a whiskey. Well, I don't know, Darren said, and looked over to the Countess and Jason, both intensely focused on each other. I think it's nice that the revolution will happen, and all we have to do to reap the benefits is show up.
For as long as it lasts, anyway, Nadashe said.
She pulled out a second tumbler, poured whiskey into it, and handed it to Darren.
Thank you, he said,
and then raised it to her. Here's to for as long as it lasts.
Amen.
Nadashe looked at him, took a sip of her drink, and made a snap decision. She turned to her mother.
Darren wants to see the ship, she said. I'm going to give him a tour.
Yes, fine, the Countess said, and went back to her discussion with Jason. Darren turned to Nadashe. I want to see the ship, do I?
Yes, you do, Nadashe said. Some parts of it more than others.
Thank you, by the way, Nadashe said after she had gotten off and Darren had made sure to get his, too.
You're welcome, Darren said. And thank you, too.
Not for this, Nadashe said.
Wow, that bad.
It was definitely not bad, Nadashe assured him.
I meant for making sure I didn't get stabbed with a spoon in prison.
Oh, that, Darren said. It was nothing. Your savior is a former member of the house's security detail. Had a divorce, got into some hard stuff to forget, messed up her life pretty badly because of it. Being in prison dried her out and got her back in shape. Honestly, the best thing for her. She was happy to take the assignment from me. Made her feel a little like being on the job again.
She toothbrushed the shit out of that other woman, that's for sure. I'm pretty sure it added a few years to her visit.
Nah, no extra time. It'll turn out to be self-defense.
While she was carrying a sharpened dental instrument.
It's prison, everyone does it.
I didn't. And you almost got spooned for it.
Point taken.
So, why did you offer to help me back there?
Because I knew Jason was planning to have you killed, and I didn't think it was good business for our house to make things worse with your house.
Is that it?
And because I thought doing you a favor would be better business for our house.
Anything else?
And because I was thinking we might need a new emperor soon, and the emperor would need a consort, one whose house would be unendingly grateful for a second chance. Plus, you'd already been vetted.
You've certainly vetted me now.
I think it was the other way around, actually. But yes.
Forgive me. I was in prison. It's been a while.
Believe me, there is nothing to forgive.
But you're not going to be emperor anymore. You've settled for something less.
One, the chances I was going to be emperor were slim. Jason is hidebound and slow, but he has a lot of inertia, and he's just slightly up the food chain from me. We'd fight it out, and it would be close, but he's got the reach. Two, settling for total control of the House of Wu is a high settle. It's a pretty decent consolation prize.
It's too bad, Nadashe said. I could have gotten used to this.
Darren grinned. You don't have to give it up, you know.
Sorry, but that's not the way these things work.
I can have my toys, and Jason, if he wants them, can have his. What we can't have are people who are an actual threat.
You think I would be a threat?
I know you would be. That's why you're getting the House of Wu.
You're going to be so busy running the house and fending off the enraged cousins that you've thrown out of power that you won't even be able to look up from your desk for the next 30 years.
When you put it that way, it doesn't sound so great.
That's because it's not, at least not compared to what you could have, which is everything.
Darren was silent for a moment and then sat up in the bed. I'm not sure why you care, he said. Jason is perfect for you. He's ambitious, but he has no imagination. You can point him in whatever direction you want, and he'll go there and knock down everything in his way. Isn't that what the House of Nohamapitan wants in an emperor?
It's what the House wants, Nadashe said. It's what my mother wants.
Look how she's locked on to Jason. She knows a good maneuverable thing when she sees it.
And you don't want that? Nadashe lifted herself up, placed herself in Darren's lap, and locked her legs around him. She put her arms around his neck and started playing with the back of his cared-for but not over-attended hair.
Maybe what I want is someone I don't have to wind up and point in a particular direction.
Maybe what I want is someone who appreciates what I have to offer, rather than just agreeing to use me for their own plans and benefit. Maybe what I want is someone who will give me children who don't run the risk of being depressingly dull. Maybe what I want is someone who knows how to fuck and will keep me happy doing it. Darren grinned at this again, and Adache could feel him stirring under her, which meant he had a tolerably short refractory period, which is a thing she could appreciate, just not right this second when she was still mid-pitch. Maybe, Darren Wu, what I want is someone who will actually be an emperor, and not just a tool for me and my family. Greyland is wrong about a lot, but she's not wrong that everything is changing. We need someone who is up to it. Greyland isn't up to it. And look at Jason. I'm willing to bet he doesn't actually want to engage with the fact that things are going to be different and chaotic and dangerous for the next decade. I can push him and prod him, but he's limited to how fast and far he'll go. He'll knock down everything in his way. But he won't ever get to where we need him to go. So, maybe what I want is someone who will get there, with me helping, not pushing. Not pushing doesn't sound very Nohama Peaton, Darren said. I'm willing to work on it, Nadashe said. Darren smiled at her, and there was a flash of something actually human there, the smallest bit of uncertainty. You don't actually know me, he said. I don't actually know you. You're asking a lot from a complete stranger. I'm scheduled to be married to your cousin, who I know even less. And anyway, Darren, let's be clear what's on the table here. This is a political union, pure and simple. We know each other well enough to understand that, at least. So you, showed me the ship to get me to make a deal, Darren said. No, I did that because I needed to get laid, Nadashe said. But I'm not going to lie to you, Darren. You did the tour well enough that offering you a political deal became more interesting. I'll take that as a compliment. You should, Nadashe said. But now, I need you to tell me if you're taking me up on my offer. If not, thank you for breaking my drought. If yes, then we need to get to work. Undermining your mother and my cousin. No, Nadashe said. I want them to keep doing everything they're doing.
Chapter 18. Just before the Auvergne slipped behind Dallas Isla Prime, Mars received an encrypted text message from Hatid Roinald. Ship coming for us definitely not friendly, it said. We launched a drone to the flow shoal. It was blasted down. The crew is at stations, and the rest of us are on lockdown. Looks like we're running and fighting this one out. Pretty sure Captain Lare doesn't think this one is looking good. Someone has to have sent them, whoever they are. Lare is letting me send this one message to you. Says that if things get bad, she'll dump all the data we have for the mission in a powered-down drone and put a delayed transponder on it for you to find. It includes some new work from me you'll find interesting. Says that the request for a ship for the Dallas Eastlands was already sent. If it was, you'll just have to tough it out for a couple of weeks before it arrives. Breathe only when necessary. I'm not going to lie. Kind of wish I stayed home. Or actually went on this last away mission with you. This is what a lifetime of introversion gets me. But thanks anyway. You didn't have to listen to me when I came to you. You did. You believed me and made me a friend. I liked that about you. Signed, H. By the time the Auvergne came out of the planet's shadow, the Brancid was an expanding cloud of debris. Here's that ship, Hanton said. He pointed on the Auvergne's command screen to a dot moving toward the flow shoal back to hub. We're sure that's it? Cheryl asked. We're sure. It's the only thing in this part of the system that's moving that fast that's not in an orbit around Dallas Isla Prime. He pointed to another dot on the screen. Here's the flow shoal back to hub. At its current speed, it's going to take 20 hours to get there. It's not accelerating at the moment, which is interesting. Why is that interesting? Mars asked.
It means they're not using their engines right now, Cheryl said. Constant engine use would mean constant acceleration. Instead, they're just using inertia to coast.
Their engines could be damaged, Marsh said.
Could be.
Or they just aren't in a rush, Gammis said.
Maybe,
Cheryl said. But we accelerated into the shoal on the way here. I know that was the captain's plan on the way back. These flow shoals are on a clock, she looked over at Mars, and your predictions on how long they could be open could be wrong. No offense.
None taken, Mars said.
Captain Lowry didn't want to stay here a minute longer than she had to. We would have accelerated all the way back as fast as we could. Cheryl pointed to the dot representing the ship. If these people aren't stupid, they would be doing the same thing, so there's a reason they're not.
It's a lot to suppose on, Gammis said.
But it's not a bad supposition, Mars said. If the engines are damaged, then the Branson got some hits in. They're limping home.
But they are still planning to go home, Hanton said, which means their field generator is still functional.
As long as their engines don't give out, Cheryl said, in which case they won't have power for the field generator.
Monsieur Chenevert, Mars said, turning to the apparition.
Who smiled?
I was wondering when you would remember I was here, Lord Mars.
Can we overtake the ship?
Their path takes them past Dallas Isla Prime. If we stay where we are, we'll be behind the planet when that happens. But of course, there's no reason we have to stay where we are now. The Auvergne's engines and power systems are fully functional at this point.
Chenevert nodded toward the command screen, which blanked out, surprising Hanton, and then reappeared with a new image charting an intercept course.
If they don't accelerate, we can intercept them in 10 hours, Chenevert said. If they do accelerate, that changes things. But if their specs are similar to what you've given me for the Branson, then we intercept them in 18 hours at the latest, well before they reach the flow shoal.
And then we blast the shit out of them, Gammis said. Do what they did to the Branson.
Chenevert looked over to Mars.
Is that your intention, Lord Mars?
No, Mars said.
What? Gammis was pissed at this. These fuckers just killed our crew, sir. Returning the favor seems just about fair.
Mars shook his head.
Dead isn't useful.
I don't understand. Mars looked over to Chenevert. But you do, I hope.
I think I do, Lord Mars, Chenevert said. Can it be managed?
It depends on what shape their ship is in, and what I can figure out about it from my scans and visualizations.
I have to warn you. That means we'll have to get close.
Define close.
You won't like it if I do.
I think they know we're here, Hanton said as the ship launched a pair of missiles at the Auvergne 1,000 clicks out. Cheryl looked at the visualization of the missiles from the Auvergne sensors as they streaked toward them.
Those look like beehives, she said. They've got multiple warheads in them. They'll break open just before they hit.
That's rude, Chenevert said, and waited for the missiles to get within 100 clicks, before lancing them with his beam weapons. They vaporized soundlessly in the void.
Your beams are coherent 100 clicks out, Hanton said.
That's what I want this other ship to believe, yes, he said. I don't expect that our friends in that ship launched those missiles with the belief that they were going to hit us with them. They wanted to know how and when we would respond, and now they think they know.
You've done this before.
I told you that I've had practice being chased.
How far out are they actually effective? Mars asked.
Not this far, Chenevert said.
He popped up a visualization of the ship they were pursuing on the command screen. From slightly less than 1,000 kilometers away, the ship was a mostly indistinct wedge. The Auvergne was coming at it from an above angle relative to Dallas Isla System's ecliptic plane.
Death from above, thought Mars.
Any thoughts on this ship? Chenevert asked.
It looks like a Farthing-class ship, Cheryl said after a minute.
I'm afraid that means nothing to me, Chenevert said.
It's an interceptor ship, Cheryl said.
Small crew, fast, relatively heavily armed. It's designed to engage pirate and smuggler ships. And by engage, I mean destroy.
So there's no doubt what it was here to do, Marsh said.
I think we already have the answer to that.
Funny thing, when these ships are decommissioned, a lot of them get bought by pirate sorts. I think the reasoning there is they can outrun or fight the Navy ships sent after them.
Does that work? Chenevert asked.
The Navy just sends bigger ships.
More missiles, Hanton said.
This time the beehives launched their payloads early, and one of the smaller missiles got within 10 clicks of the Auvergne before Chenevert destroyed it.
You're still toying with them, right? Gammis asked.
If it makes you more comfortable if I say yes,
Then yes, Chenevert said.
It doesn't when you put it like that.
I'm sorry.
When the Auvergne was 200 clicks out, the ship hit them with its own particle beams. They were on the Auvergne for a full tenth of a second before they were gone, and small puffs of debris were visible coming off the attacking ship.
Oh, nice, said Gamus.
What just happened? Mars asked Chenevert.
I was waiting for the ship to open fire to confirm which features on the ship were the beam weapons. Once I knew, I took them out. And then also took out every other feature on the visible portion of the ship that resembled the beam weapons, just to be safe.
More missiles, Hanton said, pointing at the command screen. Mind you, that doesn't get rid of every defense they have, Chenevert said.
Excuse me for a moment.
50 clicks out and small details of the ship were clear to Mars and the rest of the crew on the command screen.
Are we close enough? Mars asked.
Almost, Chenevert said.
40 clicks.
Any time, Mars said.
Getting there.
30 clicks, and the ship was visibly growing in the command screen without magnification.
I'm getting a little nervous, Mars said.
Soon, Chenevert said.
Missiles, Hanton said.
That was nervy, Chenevert said a second later.
There was a tinkling sound as the debris of one of the missiles collided with the Auvergne.
10 clicks.
Now,
Chenevert said, and fired his beam.
Not at the engine itself, but at a small area up and to the right of it on the hull.
The beam bored a hole into the hull and lanced at the inside of the ship.
Air and steam and a small amount of debris vomited out.
Mars heard a thrumming inside Auvergne, a sign of adjustments being made so the Auvergne would be stationary relative to the other ship and not ram into it, destroying them both.
That's it? Gamus asked.
That's enough, Chenevert said and turned to Mars.
I needed to get close enough to get an idea of how energy routed through the ship, he said. We assumed the engine was already damaged, so I didn't want to risk that. I sent the beam through what looked like a central energy exchange route. My guess is that it stops functioning, and the engines and power systems shut down to avoid an explosion until it's repaired.
How long until it's repaired? Mars asked.
Well, I destroyed it, so never. At this point, I assume they are running ship systems on their emergency power setup.
That's enough to keep them alive for now, but not enough to run their field generator, Cheryl said. If they go through the flow shoal without a space-time bubble, they're screwed.
They're still on a glide path into the flow shoal, Hanton said. They'll hit it in 9 hours, 15 minutes.
What do we do now? Gamus said.
Have a protein bar and wait for their call, Mars said.
The call came 4 hours ahead of the shoal.
Unidentified ship, this is the princesses in another castle, the voice said over the radio connection.
Hanton had given Chenevert the frequencies that were most likely to be used for communication, and Chenevert had set the Auvergne to the task of cycling through them until something came through.
Captain Cav Ponsud speaking, please respond.
Hello, princess, Mars said. This is the Auvergne. Lord Mars Claremont here. There was a long pause.
You said Lord Mars Claremont.
That's right. There was an even longer pause this time.
What the hell? Gamus said.
Lord Mars, you have disabled our ship and we are adrift, Ponsud said when he returned. We are without main power and our emergency power is drawing down.
Acknowledged, Mars said.
Also, your current path takes you directly into the flow shoal in...
He looked at the command screen where Chenevert had helpfully set a timer. 3 hours, 52 minutes.
Please be advised that if you enter the shoal in your present condition without your field generator, you will be instantly rendered into nothingness.
Yes, Ponsud said. We are aware of that information, and thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Lord Mars, it has come to our attention that, despite disabling our ship, you have not elected to destroy us.
That is correct, Captain Ponsud.
We are wondering what your intentions are now, Lord Mars.
Well, Captain, the answer to that rests entirely on you.
Please explain.
Why did you destroy the Oliver Branson?
We were hired to.
Who hired you?
I don't know. We were hired by intermediaries who wouldn't tell me the identity of the primary contractor. I work in a very specialized contracted business field. I don't always know who was hiring me.
Thank you, Captain Ponsud. Enjoy oblivion.
Mars looked over to Chenevert, who nodded.
The circuit is muted on this end, he said.
You think he's lying about who contracted him, Cheryl said.
Mars nodded. We'll find out soon enough. 5 minutes later, Ponsud was back on the circuit asking for Mars. Mars nodded to Chenevert, who opened up the circuit.
Yes?
Lord Mars, we were hired by an intermediary, a representative of the Wu family.
Mars frowned at this. You were hired by the Imperial family?
No, not by the royal family, by the Wus that run the merchant house, cousins of the Emperor.
Who were the Wus acting as an intermediary for?
I asked that of the representative. Now, I've done business with the Wus before, it's why they contacted me in the first place, but never with them as the intermediary. They were always the primary client. The representative didn't want to say, but I told him there was no way I would take the job without knowing. The job was time-sensitive, and the Wus didn't really have any other option, so the rep swore me to secrecy and told me. The Countess Nohama Peaton.
How did the Nohama Peatons know about the Brancid in the first place?
She heard about it from the Wus. The Wus heard it from an admiral, is what I was told. The Navy is obviously close with the Wus. They get all their weapons and ships from them.
That doesn't make sense. The Wus aren't close with the Nohama Peatons.
I don't know the relationships of the great families, Lord Mars. I don't have time to keep up with gossip. You asked who contracted me, and I'm telling you.
Okay, but why would the Countess Nohama Peaton want to attack the Brancid?
She didn't, Ponsud said, and an exasperated Mars was about to mute the line again, but Ponsud continued from there. She didn't care about the ship one way or the other. It was a means to an end for her actual target.
Who or what was that? There was a pause on the line. Then,
it was you, Lord Mars. The Countess Nohama Peaton wanted you dead bad enough to send us to attack the Brancid to get to you.
Mars stared in disbelief. He looked around the bridge of the Auvergne to see every other set of eyes on him.
Hello?
Ponsoon said. Mars had been silent for nearly a full minute.
Why?
Mars asked.
I wasn't told that. Just that we were to make sure you were dead. I asked if that meant I could leave the Brancid crew alive if they surrendered you, and I was told that the Brancid could not be allowed to return to Hub, and I had a choice of destroying it or destroying its field generator. That would have meant marooning the crew here to a slow death by starvation or suffocation.
I opted for the faster way. It seemed more humane to me.
You should know, Lord Mars, that the Brancid put up a hell of a fight. You wouldn't have captured us without the damage they did to us first.
And the Dallas Eastlands?
The who, Lord Mars?
The people who inhabit this system, Captain.
I don't know who you're talking about, sir. I was focused on the Brancid, which was keeping me busy enough.
Are you saying that there are still people alive here? After 800 years?
Yes. It's just as well I didn't know about them. It wouldn't have done to leave anyone who could attest to what we did here.
Except for the one person you came specifically to kill.
The irony of this does not escape me, Lord Mars. I'm telling you because I have no other choice. Neither I nor my crew wants to die here, or like this.
You're asking me to give you an option that you wouldn't give to the crew of the Brancid.
Lord Mars, if I didn't believe you would entertain the option, I wouldn't have opened my mouth.
Hold on, Mars said, and looked at Chenevert, who nodded and muted the connection. Mars sat down heavily in a chair, put his face in his hands, and sobbed.
It's, Hanton began, but Mars held up a hand at him.
Hanton stopped and looked uncomfortable. It was a common look around the room. After a minute, Mars nodded to Chenevert, who opened the connection again.
You're going to testify about all of this, Captain Ponsud.
If that is what it takes to keep my crew alive, Lord Mars, I'll repeat everything I told you to any judge you pick.
You're not going to tell it to a judge, Captain. You're going to tell it to the Emperor, to her face, and I will be there as you do it. There was a long silence. Then,
understood, Lord Mars. With that said, I officially surrender the princess to you. You are in command now.
Mars nodded, then realized that Ponsoon would not be able to see that over an audio connection.
Thank you, Captain. My associate, Mr. Chenevert, will be discussing with you soon all the details of transferring yourselves over to the Auvergne.
Be ready.
I will. The sooner the better.
Understood. Mars nodded to Chenevert. You can handle that?
I'm already talking to Captain Ponsuit about it.
Mars was momentarily confused about this until he remembered that Chenevert was a virtual being. He supposed a virtual being could make as many versions of himself as he wanted. He nodded his understanding.
Is there anything specific we want brought over from the princess? Chenevert asked. Aside from the crew, of which I am informed there are 7.
Small crew, Cheryl said.
Ours is smaller.
I want as many of their ship's records as possible, Mars said, plus any evidence Ponsuit has for contracting with the Wooz.
I'm guessing this was a cash enterprise, Gamus said.
It probably was, but I still want as much evidence as I can get.
We need as much food as they can bring over, Gamus said to Chenevert. Everything they have. I'm already sick of protein bars.
Is there any way we can salvage that ship? Mars said.
The Dallas Eastlands could probably scavenge everything from that.
Captain Ponsuit tells me the princess has a small shuttle which they will use to transport themselves and food over, Chenevert said. Depending how much time we take bringing things over and whether it's remotely pilotable, I can probably use it to nudge the princess out of the path of the flow shoal. Nota will likely damage both the shuttle and the princess.
Better than nothing.
Quite literally, in this case, Chenevert agreed. If after that time the shuttle is not too damaged, then I will see if I can program it to push the princess along to the Dallas Eastlands. Then they can salvage both ships.
I want to leave them the Branson shuttle as well, Mars said. No place for it here anyway. I don't want to leave it parked over Dallas Isla Prime.
We have to go back and get Steve and Lighten, Cheryl said. We can't leave them here.
I can program our shuttle to fly itself to the Dallas Eastland ship, Hanton said, then pick up Steve and Lighten and the data from the Brancid and back through the shoal to Hub.
If the Wooz knew where the Brancid was, then they know there's a possibility of it coming back, Cheryl said. The Brancid could have fought off the princess.
So you think they'll have someone waiting for us on the other end of the shoal, Marsh said.
I would, Cheryl said, if I were them.
We're not going to be in the Brancid, Gamus said.
No, but we'll be coming through the flow shoal from Dallas Isla, Cheryl said. If I were them, I'd be blasting anything that came through that, including the princess. The fewer witnesses, the better.
Mars thought about that and turned to Chenevert.
Ask Captain Ponsuit if he has any message drones.
It does, Chenevert said a moment later. He says they intended to send one after the Branson was destroyed, but forgot because they were too busy trying to get the ship to the flow shoal and then fighting us off.
Tell him to send one confirming my death and the destruction of the Brancid, and then say they are going to stay behind for a month to salvage the habitats. Give a specific date they plan to leave this space.
Mars looked over to Cheryl. If the Wooz are planning to have someone blast them, they'll reschedule to match dates.
Sneaky, Cheryl said.
I don't want to be blasted to bits. He turned back to Chenevert. And you finally will be able to visit the Interdependency.
Wait, you want to use this ship to get back to the Interdependency? Chenevert said.
I can't do that. I don't have a field generator.
They all stared at him.
I'm joking, he said. Of course I do.
We need to talk about your sense of humor, Mars said, after he and every other human in the room recovered from their mini heart attacks. Being semi-dead seems to have affected it.
It was like this before, Chenevert said.
How do you think I died?
Book 3 Chapter 19 Shortly before the Brancid was scheduled to return into Interdependency space, an appointment the ship and its crew would miss, 2 more flow streams disappeared. The first was the stream from Marlow to Kealakekua. The 2 systems were lightly inhabited, and direct trade between them was infrequent, as their direct flow stream took a month to traverse, while routing through Baylagan cut 10 days off the journey. It was a reminder that the time in a flow stream was not necessarily related to the distance between 2 systems, and also the intricacies of the flow were something only a few people understood to any extent. As a consequence of this, the flow stream between Marlow and Kealakekua was only infrequently used for legitimate shipping and travel. It had instead become a favorite of smugglers, pirates, and others who didn't mind taking a little extra time if it meant avoiding Navy interceptors and local customs enforcement.
When the flow stream disappeared, no legitimate commerce or transportation was listed as lost. The 8 ships and 1,000 people who were lost were all on private, unlisted, or illegal transports. There was no paperwork for their itineraries, no bills of lading, and no record of their comings and goings. They were simply gone. Their customers, clients, and loved ones would never know what had become of them, because they would not necessarily have known they had taken that route at all. The second stream was not so obscure. It connected the systems of Guelph and Seged, both systems considered part of the population and economic core of the interdependency. Due to the nature of the flow, the Count Clermont's work on its collapse and the estimated schedule of flow disruptions had yet to make it to Guelph, and the commerce and travel between the two systems was in full flower when the flow stream collapsed, unannounced and, to the people of Guelph, unpredicted. The impact was immense. Tens of thousands of people disappeared, including 2 passenger ships, the Allure of the Stars and the Oasis of the Stars, which between them carried 10,000 souls. More than 1 billion marks of commerce evaporated. The journey from Guelph to Seged, previously 7 days and 8 hours, would now be more than 1 month through alternate routes. The return route from Seged to Guelph remained open, but Seged stopped all traffic outbound for fear of a similar collapse. Guelph stopped all its commercial traffic to its 3 other exiting flow shoals until an explanation could be found. The explanation would arrive from Hub more than 1 month and billions of marks of lost commerce later. It was a wound on the cultural soul of Guelph that would never fully heal. Along with the disappearance of these 2 flow streams, the phenomenon of evanescence, sketched out to Greyland by Mars and Roynald, was having its effect as well. Tearing open a flow stream between Oikusa and Artibonite that lasted, unnoticed, 1 week before disappearing in as unheralded a fashion as it arrived. It was just as well that no enterprising ship had tried to enter its temporary shoal, as the transit time between the two systems would have been along the order of 5 weeks, longer than the stream itself would exist. A stream of even shorter duration, between End and Neunkirchen, existed for 15 minutes. A corresponding return stream would open up 7 minutes later and disappear 20 minutes afterward. Like the stream between Oikusa and Artibonite, it would go unnoticed in either system. But briefly, End, traditionally the most isolated system in the interdependency, and recently even more isolated than usual, had a back door in and out of it. That no one knew it or could have used it didn't change the fact that it had been there. In the memory room, Cardinia called up Raquel I, the first prophet emperor, who stood before her, silent, waiting for her to ask something. "Did you ever have doubts?" Cardinia asked. "About what?" Raquel I said. Cardinia laughed, because of course that was the most Raquel answer possible. Cardinia had summoned up the memory of the first emperor numerous times now to discuss the nature of visions and how to sell them and how to make them stick, if not to the members of the nobility, then to the masses, to whom they were pitched in the first place. In all the time Cardinia had been talking to her great-great-great ancestress, Raquel had never once projected, figuratively and literally, as her image was projected from clever lighting in the memory room's ceiling, anything other than serene confidence. Some of that was probably because Cardinia's Raquella was not the real Raquella. Just a bundle of memories and emotions animated by a heuristic-oriented AI that could tell you what Raquella was feeling at a particular moment in time, but couldn't feel that emotion itself. Or any of the emotions of any of 87 previous emperors, including her father. Cardinia was aware that, technically speaking, none of these emperors existed, and she was merely talking to Gigi, the memory room's avatar, who put on the former emperors like she might put on a new shirt. But when Raquel I or Ottavio VI was standing in front of you, it was easy to forget you weren't speaking to the actual person. But, computer simulation or not, lack of actual emotion or not, it was still the case that at least some of the residue of every emperor's personality came through in conversation. Emperors who had been neurotic talked and answered questions like a neurotic person. The blustery, stupid ones gave blustery and stupid answers. The creepy ones, and there were a few, were made even creepier by the lack of overt emotion. Raquella I's affect wasn't creepy, or blustery, or neurotic. She was just Raquella. Confident. The sort of confidence Greyland was getting good at pretending at, but still working on actually feeling. Greyland considered Raquella I's question. All right. Did you ever have doubts about anything?
Of course. Only a sociopath lacks doubt, and I wasn't a sociopath when I was alive.
Are you now?
If you brought a psychiatrist in here and had them give me an evaluation, I would probably come across as a sociopath. I currently, fundamentally, lack empathy, though I can pretend to it, which may be a textbook definition of sociopathy. I don't have any doubts now, certainly.
But you did when you were alive.
Yes, many. Ranging from very small and trivial doubts about people, things, and incidents, to larger existential doubts, for example, about whether we would be able to pull off founding the interdependency.
Why did you have doubts? Leaving aside any of my own personality quirks, because it made sense to have doubts.
It made sense to worry that our plans were not complete, and that there were contingencies we had not thought of, that I had not thought of, that would come back and affect how events would play out.
And did they? Did your doubts come true?
Sometimes they did.
How did you deal with that?
We made new plans as well as we could and put them into effect.
You improvised.
Yes. The one advantage we had, which is a thing I brought to the Enterprise, was the understanding that the plan was not the goal. The goal was the goal, and we were going to get to it however we could. And if it meant changing our plans, sometimes in the middle of executing them, then we would.
You sound proud of it, Cardenia observed.
I was. I mean, you sound proud of it now. You, the simulation.
I'm not, but Raquella was. And it makes sense to reflect that pride to you. It's why I became Empero. I was always meant to be Empero, I should clarify. The Wu family always knew they needed a front person who could balance both the state and church roles, a useful figurehead for both. But I was more than a figurehead, because I was the one reminding the others constantly that the plan was not the goal. We succeeded because of it.
Did you doubt that your prophecies would work?
Sometimes.
Something we worked out between ourselves would go out in the world and fall flat, and I would have to spin it and sometimes abandon it altogether. I've told you before that the prophecies were aspirational, not predictive. It's only after we worked to make them come true that they had the appearance of inevitability, and we worked very hard on that.
Making prophecies and getting them across successfully is much harder work than I expected, Cardenia admitted.
It's very hard work, Raquella agreed. I retired them as soon as it was practically possible. I know no other Empero before you bothered to have any, because it made no sense to have them. They were already Empero, so much of the hard work of establishing a rule was already done. All they had to do was maintain that rule. We set it up so that it would be easy to do through the tools of the state.
So you're saying I shouldn't have bothered with prophecies?
I didn't say that.
Because you're not actually a human and have no interest in it outside of what I tell you.
There is that. And also, your reign is unlike the reign of any of your predecessors, including mine. I worked hard to form the interdependency, but I wasn't the Empero then. When I became the Empero, in most ways my crisis, the formation of the interdependency, was over. The House of Wu had succeeded. Your crisis is the dissolution of the interdependency. You must prepare the systems of humanity to be alone. You have the tools of the state to do it, but the tools of the state will almost certainly not be enough. So now you must use the tools of the church as well, which is why they were there for you. I put them there for you to use. Not you specifically, but any emperor who found themselves in this position.
Cardenia's eyes narrowed at this. You anticipated the collapse of the flow?
No, Raquella I said. I never really understood the flow. It always looked like a lot of math, and I had people for that. But I did anticipate that there might be a time where an Emperor might need more options than just being the Emperor, that they might have to take on the mantle of Prophet as well. You are the second Prophet Emperor. Cardenia recoiled.
Oh, I don't call myself that.
I don't see why not.
It's a little arrogant, and also I don't think it's a title I can give myself. I think others have to use it first.
From a marketing point of view, I can tell you that you're wrong. If you want people to use the title, you should start using it yourself, or at least start seeding it out there through your propagandists.
We call them the press ministry now.
Whatever. Have them start spreading it around. It will help more than you think it will.
I have doubts, Cardenia said.
I did marketing, I know.
No, Cardenia said, not about that. I mean, larger doubts. About everything.
Of course you do. You're human.
I'm glad you noticed.
I can tell you're hoping for some wisdom from me right now.
It ruins it a little when you put it like that, just so you know. I will remember to approach it more organically the next time. Thank you.
Would you like the wisdom anyway?
Yes, Cardenia said. Yes, I would.
It's this. Confidence isn't about knowing you're right. Confidence is about knowing you can make it right. You have doubts because it makes sense for you to have doubts, just like it made sense for me to have doubts. But remember, the plan is not the goal. What is your goal?
To save as many lives as possible, through every means possible.
Be confident in that, and everything else will follow.
Thank you, Cardenia said after a minute. What you said about confidence makes sense to me.
You're welcome, Raquel the First said. I read it in a book once.
Cardenia emerged from the memory room to find Obelise Atek waiting for her. Atek had a mildly apprehensive look on her face, in part because she was always uncomfortable coming into the Emperor's private apartments, which she felt was an invasion of personal space, and in part because she didn't know what the memory room was, and it disturbed her. Cardenia had explained to her that it was a relaxation chamber of sorts, which was occasionally accurate, but she didn't think that made Atek's apprehension any less acute. Cardenia smiled at her assistant, took a breath, and became Greyland the Second again.
Is my next appointment here? Greyland asked.
She is, ma'am, waiting for you in your office.
Atek motioned with her hand for the Emperor to lead the way.
In her office, Lady Kiva Lagos waited, leaned way back in a chair, looking up at the ceiling, kicking one foot casually as she did so. Greyland was amused by this. Most visitors were overwhelmed by the office and its centuries of priceless cruft. But Kiva gave every impression of, yeah, you have a lot of shit in this place, so fucking what? Which Greyland could definitely sympathize with.
Atek discreetly coughed. Greyland saw Kiva look over, see Atek giving her the get the hell up signal, and haul herself out of her chair for a bow.
Lady Kiva, good to see you again, Greyland said, and excused Atek from the room. Sit back down, please.
I was staring at your ceiling, Your Majesty, Kiva said, sitting back down. I don't think I've ever seen so much gold foil in one place.
It's a lot, yes.
One of the perks of being Emperor.
I suppose it is. I honestly don't think about it much. I rarely look up at the ceiling these days.
Give it a try sometime, ma'am. It's pretty impressive.
How is your friend doing? I'm sorry, her name escapes me at the moment.
Senia Fundapalonin.
It's a lot to remember.
I told her the same thing when I first met her. She's doing much better, thank you, ma'am, and thank you again for sheltering her at Brighton Palace. It makes her feel a lot safer.
Of course. And how are you? I know your friend was injured, but the bullet went through your window.
I've replaced the window with something a little more bulletproof, Kiva said. But other than that, I'm still at my place. If someone wants to come find me, they know where I am.
I don't know whether that's brave or foolish, Lady Kiva.
It's definitely foolish, ma'am. But if someone is going to make that much of an effort, then it doesn't matter where I sleep, so I might as well sleep at home. Besides, I have a good idea who did it. I've expressed my displeasure.
I hear rumors that the same night your friend was shot, Countess Nohama Peaton's chief of staff was assaulted in her bed.
I wouldn't know anything about that, ma'am.
No, I suppose you wouldn't.
Greyland nodded over to Kiva's hand, which was bandaged.
What happened to your hand, Lady Kiva?
This? Kiva held up her hand. I broke it against something stupid.
Was it worth it?
Absolutely, ma'am.
Well,